And so when you think about sort of the what is asked of patients with cystic fibrosis on a daily basis, when we're asking them to do these airway clearance treatments that can take at minimum 20 to 30 minutes twice a day, in addition to taking multiple oral medications throughout the day, it can often be a very time-consuming process when they're well, and even more so in the setting of illnesses when we ask them to increase the frequency of these treatments more often during the day.
I'm Jonathan Alisea, and you're listening to the Rare Disease Report podcast. May is Cystic Fibrosis Awareness Month. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, cystic fibrosis, or CF, is a genetic disorder affecting nearly 35,000 individuals in the United States. Caused by a mutation of the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator gene, CF is typically characterized by a buildup of mucus leading to airway blockage and increased likelihood for infection. Patients also have difficulty with proper digestion and absorption of nutrients. As a result, patients may suffer from malnutrition, growth deficiencies, and lung damage, among other possible outcomes. It is a potentially life-threatening disease, one that currently has no cure. In this episode of the Rare Disease Report, I have the opportunity to speak with Dr. Jordana Hoppe, a pediatric pulmonologist based at Children's Hospital Colorado. She talked to me about the pathophysiology of the disease and explained exactly what CF is, who it affects, and how it may be managed. She also stressed the importance and significance of universal newborn screening, how that has altered and optimized care for this particular patient population. Hoppe talked about the ongoing state of research for CF, current and investigative therapies, including her own recent work with CFTR modulators in younger populations. As expected, we covered a lot of ground while remaining committed to one goal: bringing you the most up-to-date and accurate Rare Disease Report. Enjoy. To start off, why don't you just tell me a bit about yourself, the work you do, and then we're going to go right into talking about cystic fibrosis.
So my name is Jordana Hoppe. I'm an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and a pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Hospital Colorado. As a pediatric pulmonologist, one of my areas of interest is cystic fibrosis, and I have experience both in clinical care and research related to cystic fibrosis.
To get right into it, why don't you just tell me about cystic fibrosis first? What is it? And if you want to add in any historical context to it to kind of round it out, that would be great.
So cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease. It's inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, meaning that you receive one mutation from the mother and one mutation from the father in order for a child to have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis was first developed in the late 1930s by a pathologist called Dorothy Anderson. And she described the pathologic changes that were seen in the pancreas, which is one of the organs affected by cystic fibrosis, and noticed that there was both cysts and fibrosis within the pancreas, and so coined the term cystic fibrosis of the pancreas. And it was at that time that cystic fibrosis was first recognized as a disease in people. And after that, the sort of next phase in better understanding the diagnosis of CF and how we could make the diagnosis was in the late 1940s. During some heat waves, a physician called Dr. Paul de Saint Agnes recognized that children who had been diagnosed with cystic fibrosis appeared to be more susceptible to heat exhaustion during the summers, during a period of heat waves. And so he did further studies that determined that people with CF lose more salt through their sweat. And this became the basis of the sweat test, which is the gold standard for diagnosis in cystic fibrosis. And it wasn't until 1989 that the CF gene was eventually discovered. And since that time, there have been more than 1,000 different mutations that lead to cystic fibrosis that have been identified within that gene. Cystic fibrosis leads to abnormalities in multiple parts of the body. And these abnormalities are caused by changes in the CF protein, which when you have CFTR mutations, the CF protein is made abnormally. And this protein is found within cells and is responsible for the passage of salt and water across cells. And so when you have a protein that's not working correctly, salt and water does not move across the cells, and this leads to the downstream consequences of cystic fibrosis. So in the lungs, that abnormal movement of salt and water leads to thick, stickier mucus within the airways. And when that thick, stickier mucus stays there, it leads to increased risk of infection with certain bacteria, and then ultimately can lead to lung function decline over time. In the pancreas that we talked about earlier, there's abnormalities in the pancreatic duct. And so we typically make enzymes within our pancreas that then leave the pancreas through the pancreatic duct to the small intestines, where it helps us break down fats and proteins within the food that we eat. However, in cystic fibrosis, that pancreatic duct gets blocked and the enzymes cannot get out correctly. And this causes CF to be at increased risk of malnutrition because they're unable to digest fats and proteins in their foods correctly. This also puts them at increased risk for nutritional abnormalities as well. And as I mentioned, with the discovery of sort of higher salt within the sweat, people with CF are at increased risk of dehydration because of salt losses from their sweat glands. There are other parts of the body that can also be affected by cystic fibrosis as well, including the sinuses and the liver and other abnormalities within the digestive tract.
So are there certain populations that are more prone to getting cystic fibrosis, or does it just generally tend to affect anyone and everyone? What does the sort of scope look like for that?
So mutations within the CFTR gene occur with the highest frequency within Caucasian populations, but abnormalities in the CFTR gene and mutations are found within all racial and ethnic groups. And so although cystic fibrosis is more common within Caucasians, it is seen within people from all different racial and ethnic backgrounds.
Since you work a lot with patients with cystic fibrosis, what is the experience with it? What are these patients going through with this condition? Can you just explain more of that and to sort of flesh out the patient quality of life for them?
Yeah, so typically cystic fibrosis is diagnosed within the newborn period. And the most common way that it is now being diagnosed is through newborn screening. So this is blood testing that is done on all newborns who are born in the United States. And it tests for a variety of different metabolic and other disorders, one of which is cystic fibrosis. So typically through the newborn screening method, we are identifying children with cystic fibrosis before a month of age. And this is important because, as I mentioned, there are nutritional abnormalities that we see as a result of cystic fibrosis. And so by identifying these babies early, we're able to intervene before they start to have a lot of those nutritional abnormalities and symptoms. At the time of diagnosis, we begin several treatments for cystic fibrosis, and these treatments do become lifelong therapies. So from a nutritional standpoint, in order for people with CF to digest fats and proteins in the food they eat, we give replacement pancreatic enzymes by mouth, so every time that they eat. So if you can imagine a new baby who's just a few weeks old, maybe eating every 2 to 3 hours during the day, and parents are required to give the pancreatic enzymes each time they eat in order for the baby to get the nutrients and calories from that breast milk or formula that they're receiving. We also start treatment with CF-specific vitamins. There are certain vitamins that are absorbed with fat. And so when fats are not digested well, you're at risk for nutritional deficiencies. And these include vitamins A, D, E, and K. We also add supplemental salt to the diet of people with CF because we know that they lose more salt through their sweat. We replace salt so that they do not become dehydrated. And so as you can see, there's a lot of nutritional therapies that we start right away at the time of diagnosis for somebody with CF. And it's also important to point out that people with CF tend to require more calories than those without CF. And so often patients are receiving additional calories throughout the day, either with more frequent meals or snacks, or sometimes nutritional supplements as well to increase the number of calories that they're receiving. There are also treatments that we recommend from a respiratory standpoint as well. I had mentioned that as a consequence of CF, that the mucus within the airways becomes thick and stickier. And this makes it harder to clear and puts people at increased risk for having respiratory infections. So in order to help move mucus out of the lungs, we recommend airway clearance beginning shortly after diagnosis. And so for a newborn, this is through a process called chest physiotherapy, in which parents will take rubber cups and tap on the chest and the back and the sides of the chest. And this helps to loosen mucus from the airways so it can be cleared more easily. For older children and adults, there are other airway clearance mechanisms that can be used. The most common one is the vest, in which it looks almost like a life vest. So it goes over the shoulders and snaps in the front. And then it creates pressure and vibration to help loosen the mucus from the airways and move it more centrally so it can be cleared. There are also additional therapies that get added on later in childhood and are continued in adulthood that help to thin and make the mucus in the airways more easy to clear. In addition to this, in the setting of respiratory illnesses, when someone is having more mucus production or increased coughing, antibiotics are often started as an additional treatment as well. And so when you think about sort of the what is asked of patients with cystic fibrosis on a daily basis, when we're asking them to do these airway clearance treatments that can take at minimum 20 to 30 minutes twice a day, in addition to taking multiple oral medications throughout the day, it can often be a very time-consuming process when they're well, and even more so in the setting of illnesses when we ask them to increase the frequency of these treatments more often during the day.
Before we, because I have a follow-up question for the treatments, but I want to actually go back to you mentioned the universal newborn screening that you do. I know depending on the rare disease we're talking about, that could sort of be a hot topic, and there's always seems to be a lot more work that needs to be done for screening and universal newborn screening. What are your thoughts on sort of the state of screening for cystic fibrosis? Do you think that there still needs to be more work done in the screening for it?
Yeah, so newborn screening with cystic fibrosis is something that really developed over, you know, a number of years to decades. Colorado was the first state in the United States to begin newborn screening for CF in 1982, but it wasn't until 2009 where it was adopted in all 50 states. Newborn screening for cystic fibrosis is important because it helps to identify those individuals before they start to show a lot of symptoms. So I mentioned that typically we diagnose a child with CF through newborn screening by a month of age. And even at that time, some of those infants are already starting to have difficulties with gaining weight. Babies typically after they're born will lose weight initially and then start to regain it. And it's in a child who's healthy, they tend to be back to their birth weight by 2 weeks of age. But what we see in some of these children diagnosed with CF, even through newborn screening, is that they've struggled to even get back to their birth weight by the time they're diagnosed. And so this can create a lot of stress for families if they feel like they're not able to get their babies to grow. And so being able to make the diagnosis and then start treatments to help with weight gain and improving nutrition is really important. It's also important because historically, before newborn screening was available for cystic fibrosis, these children would present with really severe failure to thrive, where they would have had a very prolonged period of difficulty gaining weight. They may also have started presenting with respiratory symptoms as well, pneumonias, and that, as a result, could have led to lung damage too. So by identifying these patients early, we're then able to start treatments earlier to therefore hopefully, you know, prevent and delay some of the downstream consequences of cystic fibrosis. So fortunately now, newborn screening for cystic fibrosis is available in all 50 states. However, it's important to remember that newborn screening is just a screen, and there can be situations where children who have cystic fibrosis are missed on newborn screening. And so therefore, as you know, pediatricians and as clinicians who take care of children with respiratory symptoms, it's important to always keep in the back of our minds that it is just a screen. And if a child ever has symptoms suggestive of cystic fibrosis, that they do require further diagnostic testing to either rule out or rule in the diagnosis.
And I know you primarily work with children, but what about instances where cystic fibrosis is diagnosed later or later in life? Is that ever a situation for people who may develop it later? Is that more seen in the younger populations? Is that or more of a concern?
Yeah, the majority of people with cystic fibrosis are identified as children. However, I mentioned that most people with cystic fibrosis have abnormalities in their pancreas that makes them pancreatic insufficient, meaning that they don't make the enzymes to be able to digest fats and proteins. And so in that situation, people will typically present in childhood because of difficulties with weight gain if they're not captured by a newborn screening. However, there is about 10% of the CF population that is pancreatic sufficient, meaning that their pancreas works and they're able to produce enzymes. So they're able to grow normally and digest the fats and proteins in the foods they eat. In this situation, it's possible for somebody to present in adulthood, typically with recurrent respiratory symptoms that ultimately ends up being diagnosed as CF. Although this is more rare, with the majority of individuals being diagnosed in the newborn period now or historically before newborn screening as children.
What do you see as the remaining gaps in treatment potentially, or the work that still needs to be done in optimizing care for these kinds of patients?
So the treatment that is at this point helping patients both in terms of their quality of life as well as their outcomes are CFTR modulators. And these are medications that people take orally that helps the CFTR protein to work better. When the CFTR protein works better, salt and water moves across the cell better, and that helps to improve all of the downstream consequences of CF. So mucus can be cleared more easily from the lungs, for example. Less salt is lost through the sweat, making patients less likely to become dehydrated as well. CFTR modulators are available for some of the CF population, but not all. So right now, the most highly effective CFTR modulator is a treatment that's known as Trikafta. This is three medications in one. It's called Elexacaftor, Tazacaftor, Ivacaftor. And this therapy is currently available for children who are 12 years and older, who have at least one copy of the F508del mutation, which is the most common mutation in cystic fibrosis. And so this treatment will ultimately, as it's approved down into younger age ranges, be available for about 90% of the CF population based on their CFTR mutations. For those children who are younger, there are some modulators that are potentially less effective, but are available for a subset of patients, specifically those who have two copies of the F508 mutation. There are one treatment that's available known as lumacaftor, ivacaftor, or Cambi, that is available for those with two copies of the F508del mutation down to 2 years of age. And there are other treatments that are available for a minority of patients with cystic fibrosis down to younger age ranges as well, based on their mutations that they have. So in terms of what the sort of gaps are, unmet needs, we do need to perform studies to make sure that these more highly effective modulator, known as Trikafta, can be approved down into younger age ranges. Additionally, I mentioned that that treatment will only be effective for about 90% of the CF population. So there's the remaining 10% for which a modulator is not currently available. For the majority of those individuals, it's because their CF mutations causes them not to make enough CF protein for a modulator to be effective. And so ultimately, in order to find treatments for all people with CF, there will need to be additional work done in identifying ways in which we can help that individual to make CF protein, or potentially fix or editing the CFTR gene in order to find effective treatments for 100% of people with CF.
Are you aware of any new research that's out there for CF that's on your radar at least, or that you may want to speak to?
Yeah, so recently I was involved in research looking at the long-term safety of CFTR modulators in younger age ranges between the ages of 2 and 5 with a CFTR modulator lumacaftor ivacaftor. And so this is a therapy that is now available for people with CF who have two copies of F508 mutation. And so we know that lumacaftor ivacaftor has a modest improvement in terms of this, of its effect on the CFTR protein. However, it's important for there to be options for CFTR modulation beginning early in life so that we can hopefully prevent and delay some of the downstream consequences of cystic fibrosis before more effective treatments are available in this age range. And so in this study, we looked at the long-term safety of this treatment in children 2 to 5 years of age, and found that for those receiving therapy, it was safe for up to 120 weeks of use, and that there were no new safety concerns identified in the 96-week extension study compared to the initial phase 3 trial that was performed in this age range. Additionally, we saw that the treatment was also effective for these children with cystic fibrosis as well, and that treatment with lumacaftor ivacaftor was associated with improvements in weight and body mass index. It was also associated with reductions in sweat chloride measurements. And so this is a marker that demonstrates reductions in salt losses through the sweat and is a way of measuring the activity of the CFTR protein, so is a sign that it is working better. We also saw that for a subset of children in this study, that they also had improvements in their pancreatic function as well, that was measured by improvements in pancreatic elastase measurement. There are upcoming studies of Trikafta, the more highly effective CFTR modulator down into younger age ranges. Right now, we're hoping that approval down to 6 years of age will be coming shortly from the FDA. And then there are studies planned for this modulator therapy down into younger age ranges as well, down to age 2, that will happen later this year. The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is committed to finding therapies for all people with CF. And so for those remaining 10%, there has been a significant investment by the CF Foundation to identify additional treatments to help those who may not benefit from modulator therapy.
Great. And as my final question, for those clinicians who are working with patients with cystic fibrosis, what do you see as the major things that they should know and understand about the disease and in treatment like sort of like the big takeaway points.
So I think cystic fibrosis is a complex disease. It affects many parts of the body. And so I am a pediatric pulmonologist and specialize in children who have underlying lung disease. But as I mentioned in the overview about cystic fibrosis, it's not just the lungs that are affected. And so it really takes a whole team of individuals in order to provide the best quality care for somebody with cystic fibrosis. So when we see our patients in clinic, it really is a team approach, not only with physicians, but also with dietitians to help meet the nutritional needs of our patients, respiratory therapists who help us optimize the airway clearance therapies that patients are receiving, pharmacists to make sure that the treatments that we're prescribing don't potentially interact, or to help us determine the best antibiotic treatments or other therapies that we can use with our patients. And as I mentioned, these treatments are very time consuming, and it's a lot for somebody to have to do on a daily basis. So we also have social workers and psychologists that are part of our team in order to address any behavioral or mental health concerns that develop for patients as they recognize the impact of their chronic disease on their daily life. We also work with other physicians as well, such as gastroenterologists or endocrinologists, as well as ENT physicians, when there's other organ systems that are affected in our patients and those who require more in-depth treatment for those areas. So I think the biggest takeaway is that it takes a whole team of people to care for someone with cystic fibrosis, and it's not just the physician alone who can provide the best care.
Well, those are all the questions I have. Thank you so much, Dr. Hoppe. Make sure to check out the Rare Disease Report page at HCP Live and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platforms. And you can follow the Rare Disease Report on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Stay tuned for next month's episode on labor congenital amaurosis, featuring ophthalmologist Dr. Stephen Russell. Until next time.